although there are a couple of areas I want to cover, that maybe the first thing we ought to look at is both of these issues deal with death, both our own death and the death of those that we're close to. I thought maybe we'd start by looking at what some of the feelings that we have about death are. What things happen down here in your gut when you think about that term?
I think when a young person goes, or even in midlife when they have a lot, really things could go ahead of them. It's a worse than seeing someone who's older, who's seen life, and who, usually the older people are more acceptance of death than younger.
Okay. So some regret for life missed, perhaps.
Okay.
Other feelings?
I didn't say that.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I better not put words in your mouth then. So,
You can say that as far as a young person, yes. Fulfill the potential.
Potential missed. And then I think it is true that generally we feel that way more with a younger person. We're talking about some of the feelings that we have when we start thinking about the word death. What's happening right down here in your gut? And one of the things that was mentioned is some regret, especially when we see a young person die, of the things that they weren't able to accomplish or do. What are some of the other feelings that hit us right here?
Personal feelings of loss. Yeah.
Okay. Loss. So, again, I think you sound like you're talking from the survivor's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Loss.
With loss and also
companionship of the person who dies. What other feelings?
It's not right. You know, somehow, it's not fair.
Okay.
Not fair.
Yeah.
Always say
fair.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, and then the philosophical question, what is fair?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're still talking about losses of someone else. Any gut feelings when we think about our own deaths?
Yeah, I quite often wonder the unknown.
Okay. The unknown. Anything in particular?
I think family comes in there.
Okay. Family worries? What's going to happen to my family?
Well, not only that, but that you left a safe foundation for your family.
Okay. So, values? Grief? Issues? Let's go back to this unknown.
I don't fear death nearly as the process of getting there. That, to me,
that's
is a
true
concern.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would seem different.
Mm-hmm. The process?
Yeah.
It'll be a long, drawn, agonizing thing, but that's not...
Okay. And also, I think we have to acknowledge that there are some people who fear the unknown after.
Okay. Process, do you mean by length of sickness or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different kinds of feelings. Feelings both about our own dying and about the dying of others. So if we wanted to look at some issues, there's the process of dying. That was the one that Tom brought up. Sort of might call this here separation issues. Have you ever had the experience of having someone that you cared about die and saying, I wish I'd been able to say? Okay. So that kind of works both ways. We had someone who mentioned the idea of wanting to be sure that their children had a good foundation. Maybe the other way around. I wish I'd said something to my father, et cetera, et cetera. Grief. Both our own grieving and our knowledge of the grieving that those that will be left behind have. Other issues that you can see that we need to work on around the subject of death.
Is unresolved issues like separation, would that be the same, like conflict that's never been resolved, or situations of abuse that took place?
Okay. Resolution of conflict. I had a 7-year-old woman that I knew had a fairly strong faith life. I knew her pastor, I knew her pretty well. And it just totally astounded me in the 24 hours before she died how much just welled up of unresolved things that had happened in her childhood that she had never, and I've known this lady for 10 years, that had never come up, that she needed to deal with before she was ready to let go. I see a lot of that in survivors, but it does happen to the person dying as well. So we've kind of talked about some of the things we have to go through.
The processes of grief, I see you have listed there too.
Mm-hmm. I thought we'd talk a little bit about how we might go about dealing with some of these issues and what hospice might have to offer some families. Can someone give me a definition of hospice? What do we mean by that term?
I think it's the seeing somebody, some say terminal or something, until their death, seeing that person and their family, preparing them, if more or less preparing, not only preparing the person, but
so,
as I understand it, I don't know.
Okay. Prepare.
And also person. Take care of their personal, I mean their...
And family.
Yeah. As well as the physical aspects of...
For death, emotionally. And care for physical symptoms. Okay, who would a hospice serve?
Well, they could serve two people, people who have a terminal illness or people who have illnesses, which is long-standing, will be permanent.
Okay. Something that isn't going to get better.
That's right. A chronic, devastating chronic illness.
Okay. And that devastating, I'm glad to hear that some people have heard the more liberal definition of hospice. There's one other criteria besides the fact that this is an illness that is leading rather inexorably toward death. That makes someone appropriate for hospice. What is the goal of care in a hospice?
Comfort.
Okay.
Comfort, yeah.
Comfort, not curative care.
And comfort goes beyond just the physical, too.
Oh,
yes.
It's emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So basically, the old style definition of hospice, the Medicare definition, is someone who has 6 months or less of projected life expectancy. And I think that anyone in my business that's honest says we're absolutely lousy at predictions. And that this is becoming much less of an issue. It used to be that even though we were allowed to say, well, gosh, we don't know, we had to have at least some foundation of ability to honestly sign a document that says the statistical life expectancy for this person is less than 6 months. The other thing that we used to have to be pretty clear about, that's again pretty loose now, is the idea of what is allowed treatment. And certainly someone who's undergoing chemotherapy with the goal of conquering the illness, for instance, is not a candidate for hospice. But we do see patients in hospices who are getting radiation therapy or chemotherapy or parenteral nutrition or something of that sort, if the goal is to provide a more comfortable life. If you're drowning in fluid because of a blockage, and radiation therapy will decrease that blockage so that you can breathe more comfortably, radiation therapy is perfectly compatible with hospice. I have one little lady who was absolutely convinced that her chemotherapy helped her diarrhea. Usually it causes it. But she was convinced that chemotherapy was helping her diarrhea from her colon problems. Fine. She was in a hospice program, and she dutifully came into my office every week and got her chemotherapy. And in her case, it didn't make her nauseated. It made her diarrhea better. So be it. But the goal was not to cure that woman of her cancer. It was to provide her with a more comfortable lifestyle where she wasn't running all the time and worried about it. So a philosophy for hospice, goals are comfort, not cure. I was real, you guys are a perfect audience. You didn't give me any of the stuff that went off on tangents. Hospice. When we say the word church, you can think of a building or you can think of a group of people. Hospice is not usually a place. In fact, many hospices don't have a place. Among the philosophies of hospice is what we might call a least confining environment. And that again is real loose. Many patients express a distinct desire to have their lives end at home. I had one lady that was in a hospice program for 36 hours. She came into the hospital not clearly terminal. She became clearly terminal. She wanted, in the worst sort of way, to die with her dog on her bed. And we arranged for all the kinds of care that she needed. She's sitting in an intensive care unit. We arranged for all those kinds of care to happen at home. And I was there about an hour before she died, and her little dog was sitting on her bed when he wasn't trying to bite me. And that was very important to her and to her family. On the other hand, I see exactly the opposite sometimes. People who come into the hospital at the end because they or their family are not ready to deal with that at home. And we also have to acknowledge that the whole point of hospice, I think, at least most of those of us that work with them, are to take the patient and the family where they're at. The last hospice patient I dealt with, I was working in the emergency room one night, and this ambulance came screaming in with this lady who was vomiting blood and choking on the blood that she was vomiting. And I was, as usual, when the ambulance comes in at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm going, now what's the story? Do we know anything about why this is happening? Well, she had a lung cancer, and her lung cancer was bleeding, and she was on a hospice program, and I'm going, why the heck did this, the ambulance come out and scoop this lady up and drag her in to see me? But what had happened is that family had had a very good day the day before and did not recognize this choking on blood as being a reasonable and expected terminal event for that particular person. They saw it as a complication, a glitch, a little rock in the road, and decided that emotionally where they were at is they wanted to get over this hurdle and go back to being the way they were at home. And so for them to let mom go just wasn't going to work. They needed, for their own emotional sake, to say, we want help to see if we can fix this problem. Well, I took a look at the situation, and for several factors, it wasn't going to work anyway. Plus the fact that it was real clear as I listened to the story and interpreted what they told me is this lady was clearly terminal and had had her terminal, what some people have kind of a terminal lucid state the night before. But as it turns out, the son is a pastor that I've worked on retreat teams with since. And he has told me on several occasions that it was very important to that family to go back to a medical curative model in that last panicky minute for them. So although the philosophy is to keep the patient at home, we also deal with what are the emotional and physical needs. I've also had patients that were not comfortable at home, that there was something that even with all the good home care nursing and whatnot, they just, there's something not working. A patient just shortly before this lady with the lung cancer who, unfortunately, in my own situation, is I didn't know this lady. I could have done a lot more with that family if I had known before she arrived what the situation was. All I knew was somebody was choking and I was supposed to do something about it. In this other case, a woman who was at home, we had kind of a tough road, but the family and the home care were doing pretty well, and her last hours, just the nurses had tried all their tricks and things weren't working, and we brought her in for comfort care at the end, and that made her more comfortable and her family more comfortable, and that certainly is a reasonable thing. In that case, the hospital was a more comfortable environment than the home, whereas in many cases it's the other way too. Other things you know about the philosophy of hospice besides the idea of comfort, the idea of trying to do it in as natural an environment as possible. What other things do you think of?
Does pastor care?
Okay. Multidisciplinary. You'll find out as my Sunday school class does that I can't spell. Okay, so pastoral care, a big part. And that can be the pastor of the hospice, and they all have one, or it can be the patient's own pastor or a pastor of a family member that does that role.
Does a pastor have to? How about a layperson?
Definitely. There are most hospice programs have lay volunteers who are involved. It's not so much the title of the person who does it as it is the philosophy of talking about faith.
That's true.
Yeah. We also have family. One of the rules of most hospice programs is that each enrollee must have what's called a primary caregiver. And that need not be a family member. That could be, in the case of an AIDS patient, it could be a lover, it could be a friend. I've seen it done by neighbors. But someone who will be the, not necessarily the sole caregiver, but the one who will advocate for the patient, who will be the presence on a continuing basis.
Yeah, where does the legal definition come in there?
And there's no legal standing whatsoever. There has to be someone, as the care plans are being developed, who will take responsibility for being that.
Well, that's where the legal thing comes in, doesn't it? I would imagine at times. There's going to be some conflict there somewhere.
Sure. Clearly there's somewhere going to be someone who has a durable power of attorney for health care, whether that is, and we talked about that a couple of days ago, whether that is a legal document designating a specific person or whether that devolves out of
default law.
They can be one or be two separate.
They can be two separate people. The caregiver is the person that's there.
Yeah, I understand that.
You know, right now in my family, we have, I have a grandmother who's 98 and a mother who's undergoing chemotherapy. And we're talking about putting my grandmother into hospice to give my mother some additional support so that when she's throwing up, she isn't also getting grabbed in the toilet every 2 hours. But in that case, they have a woman that they've hired for 10 years to help with grandma's care. She might, in some senses, be designated as the caregiver. I know my mother, it'll be my mother anyway. And it, just to illustrate that, you know, if it were to come to the point where mom couldn't do it, Rosa, the housekeeper, might be the primary caregiver. Or we have lots of patients who don't have much in the line of family. It might be a niece, it might be a nephew. It might be that housekeeper that's been living with him for a while. Yes?
I have an uncle that's very active. He's 95 years old.
Uh-huh.
He's healthy. And it's a program that he's in. Apparently it's from the hospital. The lady explains it to me is there are 5-10 people. Someone's in charge of them. And these people have go-to people that need some type of assistance.
And there are certainly other programs that get help out to people. That's another talk that we didn't wind up doing this week on what do you do when you can't do it all for yourself anymore. And there are a variety of options. And certainly there are volunteer positions, not only that deal directly with those people who are dying, but simply with those who are infirm or lonely or have some other reason to need support that doesn't just kind of naturally flow from their own circle of friends and kinship. The idea that there are multiple disciplines. Nursing plays a big part in hospice. I am not a director of a hospice. I have a friend who is of the hospice that I use. And frankly, I am amazed at the amount of work that the nurses do with comfort care. They have become experts in how to make people comfortable. And frankly, when I have a patient I'm working with, and I think I'm one of their strange docs because I usually stay involved, because I know the people better than they do, although they've dealt with some of the specific comfort measures. But usually, instead of being, I call up the nurse and say, please do this for my patient, it's, you know, Marilyn, so-and-so is having a lot of pain, and we've tried this, and I'm thinking that, and what do you think? You've been out there, what do you think would be helpful? And we negotiate something. There is no one best method of pain control. There is no one best method of dealing with any of the symptoms that people who are dying might have. There are different causes for people to become part of a hospice program. Some of them may not involve a lot of pain. It may be involving breathing difficulty or loss of weight, or there may be some other event besides pain that is particularly concerning. So the idea here, and of course the way our society runs, nurses can't do anything without a doctor's order, even if that order is follow that list of suggestions and pick the one you want to use. So there is a working together, and I've certainly seen physicians who can make life difficult for the nurses and others that can make it easier for them to work with these patients. But the big thing is that the focus is on what works, what's appropriate for that person and family. I have had families that have used almost no pastoral care, and I've had families that have gotten all of their pastoral care outside the program from the church that they have been involved with over the years. And of course, we're all saying, oh, this is wonderful, this is great. But there are also ones for whom this becomes a spiritual crisis, that they don't know how to access the system. And having the system an explicit part can be very important. to their comfort level. I think we've all heard stories or experienced stories of people who don't die until Joe gets here from California, until Grandma's birthday, until Joey graduates from high school, until they get a chance to say goodbye or deal with some particular issue. There's some real interesting stuff about how women usually die after special events and men usually die right before them. Don't ask me what that means. but it's real clear that there is a change in death rates around particular events, around holidays, for instance, that says that there's a lot of psychological will that has a lot to do with the dying process. There's a book I'm reading right now called Love, Medicine, and Miracles, and it's a powerful book written by Bernie Siegel, I think there's some positive and negative power. He writes the book primarily to tell people that how they live their lives can affect how they respond to treatment, and he has lots of testimonials to people whose cancers that were, quote, hopeless have resolved because they turned their lives around and changed how they looked at life and how they looked at illness. And he makes a fairly good point that some people have to be ill, whether that's with cancer or something else, but that their messed up lives make them sick, literally, and that sometimes that is true physical illness that they develop, whether it's ulcers or cancer or something else, that it has a lot of symbolic meaning to them. But he also has the opposite message, that our will to live can change the outcome of therapy as well. So it's a powerful book, one that for some people may have a message they're not ready for, and for others may be a very powerful, helpful message. So I recommend that those that are interested in the non-medicinal part of healing can get a lot from that. Other thoughts about hospice itself?
Does hospice include after death too?
After death care for the relatives, for the family. Most hospice programs have a particular policy about making at least one or two visits with the survivors that can extend for months depending on the particular desires and needs of the family and the relationship that's developed. Hospice programs are made up of people, just like the family is made up of people. And I see my hospice teams getting more involved with some families than others. I think they tend to make more visits and stay more in touch with families they work with longer, or with families that were more appreciative of what they do. They're human. And I think they're very caring people who will care even in the face of anger and bitterness. But I think that, like any of us, they like to feel like they're useful. And if they get signals, either from very antagonistic behavior or very grateful behavior, that their presence is needed, they'll stick around.
That was the case with Malcolm. His wife died from cancer. He appreciated hospice so much that he and his daughter decided that they would try to, some way, repay.
They become volunteers.
So he got started, and he did that really so very satisfying to him.
Isn't that the way our Christian life goes? We receive God's grace through the people around us, and we pass it on. That because God loves us, we can love each other. It's not, I will be closer to God because I'm going out loving people. It's because I have received that grace that I can take that out, and that I want to take that out to other people. Each of us has different gifts. Some people that experience a good experience with hospice may find that their gifts lie somewhere else, and that not everybody wants to or is appropriate to become involved, but some do and find a great deal of meaning. I think that's another thing that we should maybe add to this unfair. The whole idea of purpose. Why did this person die? I think that's the question we're asking when we talk about unfair. And you know, there are books written on that. There are seminars done on that. There are many unanswered questions, and nobody has that wrapped up in any package. But one of the things that I think people who successfully deal with grieving do is to say, it may hurt, but out of the ashes can come some kind of growth. And that doesn't mean that it makes the death good, but it makes it meaningful. And I'm sorry?
Philosophy without the philosophy.
And that's important, really, to know that the good that does come up does not necessarily balance the pain and the anguish and the terror and the hell, because so often there is the desire to know absolutely why did God do this, therefore if I know, therefore...
The whole idea, I think that gets back to a philosophy of life. Is it a useful philosophy of life to think that we should be able to get rid of pain? Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's much more useful to say, how can I make this pain livable? How can I make something of this? And I think that's true not only of grief, but also of chronic pain. We could go through some of these same issues in dealing with chronic pain. People who are not dying, but still have to live with something they don't want to live with, whether that's arthritis, or an injury, or limitations due to a heart condition, or whatever, to be able to find meaning in where we're at in life. And some of them are easier to find meaning in than others. I know several people wanted to talk about the stages of grief. Grief is not something that happens just after somebody dies. Grief happens in the person who is letting go of life. Grief happens in the people that are getting ready to let go of that person. Kubler-Ross does list four stages of grief related to death and dying. And she makes a big point that although the average person moves from denial to anger to bargaining to acceptance, that it's very clear that that's not a smooth progression, nor is that everyone's course. Some people start out right smack in the middle of anger. You know, why do I have this cancer? Or, you know, why did my child die in that car accident? They're angry to begin with.
Sometimes it's anger against a person that died, too. This is quite common, as I understand.
Yeah. I see some other faces resonating with that one. So not only about death, but at the dying person. You know, why did you smoke those cigarettes when we told you that it would kill you? Why didn't you write a will and now I've got this mess?
Why didn't you go to the doctor when I told you to?
Uh-huh.
I mean, just thought a little.
Okay. What does that anger do to the person who has it?
They're venting, basically.
Okay. So one of the ways to deal with anger is to vent it. And that's certainly important because it's a lot harder to get rid of it if you can't talk about it and share it and validify it. But what does anger do if you keep it, if you hang on to it?
It upsets everything, psychologically and physically.
Okay.
Does that same category of people can't cry at a death? Pretty much the same?
Oh, well, you know, what do you call that, anger or denial? It represents a lack of being able to move on through the stages. I think it's pretty clear to say that it's a much more comfortable place to be at the stage of acceptance than at any of the previous stages. The can't cry at the funeral may be a matter of denial, I think we've gotten to the point where we've tried to give ourselves so much permission to cry that we think there's something wrong with people if they don't cry. Again, I think we have to, especially those of us that are around people who are grieving or dying, we have to practice what I call presence ministry. We have to take people where they are. We may be able to see something in how they're behaving that they can't see for themselves, and it may be part of that presence to reflect back to them, you know, I see that you're not crying. Is it hard for you to let go and do that? But I think that's much more helpful than to say, you ought to be crying. Well, maybe they've cried themselves out. Maybe their way of dealing with things that make them sad is not to shed tears. Certainly there are a lot of men who, this is somewhat stereotypical, but I think it's true that it's more men than women, find that it's easier to express the anger stage and to express even their denial as anger. To be angry at you when they're really denying their sadness at the loss of someone else.
But some of this is cultural too, isn't it?
Absolutely cultural. Do you have something?
No.
Oh, okay. And I think that's one of the things that we need to respect, that our culture may be different from someone else's culture. I'm a Northern European Norwegian, and you know, the idea of clapping in church and hugging people during the passing of the peace and stuff like that, 10 years ago, it's kind of like, woo, let me out of this place. Some of us change over time. I think we all change over time in different sorts of ways. But again, that whole idea of presence, we cannot expect that each grieving person is going to show their grief the way we would. And therefore, it's very important to meet them where they are. We may be able to facilitate their moving forward, but they still have to do it. We can't do it to them or make them do it. We talked a little bit about denial, that stoic person who sits there and says, no, this isn't bothering me, or who just kind of sits there kind of staring. The anger, thinking both at the person who's dying and at God and the doctors and all kinds of people, is certainly a stage. What's that stage saying?
You're reacting,
okay. It's almost a part of the denial. Anger says, if something was done differently, this wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We could have avoided this. Can we avoid that? Only one person has avoided death, and even he went through it for 3 days. That whole magical thinking that if something was different, this wouldn't have happened. It might not have happened then, but we still have anger saying, I wouldn't have to face this. Well, maybe not now, but you're going to have to face it sometime, and now happens to be the time. Bargaining. I don't think we've talked about that one. What's that like? What does that feel like? That sounds like one that we're having a little more trouble identifying with.
Would that mean that, like, why would it be me instead of my child or whatever?
God, why did you do it? Some of that's the anger stage. And I think maybe this one fits more with a person who is facing death. You know, God, if you will save me, I will do this or that or the next thing. You know, God, if you would just give me back my child, I would do this or that or the next thing. And, of course, you hear stories of people who did have a miraculous cure and went on to do some great work for God. But most of the time, this is a way of saying, I don't want it to happen. And again, magical thinking. Can I make God do something? I'm sorry. When was the last time you made God do something? I've never been able to. I've been able to ask God to change me so that I can do things differently. But that's rarely what people are talking about. And probably bargaining is most healthy and successful when it does say, God help me change, rather than God, you do it. And I think that when people have made that step from the external to the internal, some pretty neat things can happen. But not when it's at the stage of, God, you fix it for me and then I'll do something for you. It's when, God, help me do something I need to do. Acceptance, what's that like? Does that mean everything feels fine? No. What does it mean?
I think a realization of what has happened, mm-hmm. and you have to deal with it, or you're learning to deal with it, or mm-hmm. something along that line.
Okay.
Working on getting more or less working your life back into your regular.
Okay. Moving on.
Being bottom and
mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Now.
My hearing is.
You have been in bottom, and so now you.
Okay.
Start to,
okay. Coming up from bottom. And I like the way you're calling that a process. It's not when you arrive, it's when you start to go there. Because we're probably all on the journey. We never arrive much of any place. Let's talk a little bit about timing. And every situation is a little different, but how long does the grieving process take?
Varies with the individual.
Absolutely. What kinds of expectations do you have of the grieving process? How long before you think that life would have some kind of normalcy for you if someone very close to you were to die? What kind of expectations?
I don't know, all people that say always it does take years. If people always hear, like, somebody dies this summer, kind of, or next summer, and then the copy to last Christmas, and so on, they are repeating.
Mm-hmm.
All the time, okay, what did I do, thanks to you, what he was here, what did we do?
Mm-hmm.
Year after, it's starting to mellow.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Are that is done individually for yourself, and part of it is done as a community of only close friends or church friends or community.
And usually those who do their grieving together tend to do it a little faster. But the average length of grieving, and again, we're just talking about until life starts to settle into a routine again, 2 years.
About an instant death over one that has been...
Okay.
The process of happening.
Let the group take that one.
I would think that a sudden death might be more difficult to overcome.
It's harder, yeah, I think so.
Now then I see all these states as when you saw over there. It happened, we had a real good friend of ours, and he passed away like this, after heart attack. And first, she went kind of like a shock. You know, mm-hmm. it's just, you know, just like she don't really realize what really happened. And then she was so mad. I am so mad you left me this mess and I had to do this and mm-hmm. why you do that?
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that too long ago and we were driving the car and you know, then she kind of started thinking, okay, I'm gonna sell my house, buy my house and everything. Couple of months, 3 months later, she said, okay, now, if you even wanna come back, I'm not gonna take you anymore. I am on my own, I know how I live by myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna sell my house, I'm gonna move to Canada to my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But 15 months later, she passed away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
just kind of quick also. But all these stages now, I really can't see how she felt.
Yeah. One of the things I think about sudden deaths is that the stages are usually more distinct, that in expected deaths, we tend to flow more fluidly back and forth through the stages, both before and after the death. Although we might tend to think that a non-sudden death might be easier, sometimes the prolonged nature of grieving and yet not grieving because the person is still there, can be very difficult. So I think that there's no better situation. I think it's especially true when families have issues that they are trying to resolve but do not feel that they have done a good job of resolving. A prolonged death can actually be much harder. For one thing, they're totally exhausted when they start the post-death grieving process. On the other hand, truly, many families that have dealt head-on with the fact that this person is dying and that it has some very negative things can go through the after-death grieving process much more smoothly because they have had that anticipatory grief. They have had a chance to say the things they wanted to say. They've resolved some issues. The person who's dying has planned their own funeral, and there's not the in the middle of all this, I got to plan a funeral too, kind of things that can work very smoothly. That doesn't mean that there won't be that separation, that whole loss of companionship issue that doesn't become completely real until that person is physically gone. Acceptance does not mean it doesn't hurt, but it means that hurt is a part of my life now and not what seems like all of my life and overflowing from it. Many people will still tell you 10, 20 years later, there's this empty spot where my child that died is, or you know, I still miss my mother or whatever. But they can usually do it with either no tears or with tears that as soon as we're done talking about that, we can move on, as opposed to the person who can't smile, can't laugh, can't figure out how they can have fun again. That's normal in the early stages of grieving. Grief becomes abnormal when it seems to be stuck at one of the higher stages. The wife that's still angry with the husband that never taught her about the finances, even though the estate's been settled now and whatever her financial situation, good or bad, is known, who's still 2-3 years, if Alfred had just saved his money instead of buying those stupid race cars, or whatever, the person whose anger is still consuming them. I have a woman who got a divorce that was very unexpected. Her husband had found someone else. It was very normal for her to be angry at him, to be angry at his new girlfriend. But it's now 2 years after the divorce, and she's still on medication for depression, and every time I see her, she's still angry at he and his new girlfriend. She has not gone past the anger to make a new life for herself. And the challenge with her is to try to help her to see that the anger is no longer serving a good person purpose. She's articulated it. She knows where it's coming from. She's acknowledged it. But now her next task is to let go. He still has a power over her that doesn't belong.
Do some people remarry because of that reason?
Oh, absolutely. Or the whole idea that I can, by replacing the function of husband or wife, I can replace the loss. But you don't replace the shared experiences, that intimacy that we talked about in the Bible study this morning. that you can't replace. You can reform a new intimacy, and you can re-meet your needs for intimacy, but you do not replace that specific relationship, whether it was good or bad. And that's one of the problems we often see in remarriage, especially of divorced people, is that if they didn't work through why they got the first divorce, they just replace the first alcoholic with the second alcoholic or the third alcoholic. It's not until you have gone through the stages of how did I get here, am I a whole person without that without the person that I've lost, am I whole, that you can go. And some people marry successfully on the rebound. They may not be finished with the grieving process, but that new relationship is one in which they can continue to grow. They can't freeze there and do well. But, depends a lot on the individual. We all have to grow. We have to keep growing as time goes on. So that there's no way to say this is the right way to do it. But it's a definite danger that someone in denial may try to replace the family that gets pregnant right after they lose a child, the person who gets divorced or loses the spouse in a car accident, who remarries, like you say, on the rebound. There's warning signs there, danger. Other thoughts?
Probably the only other thing I was thinking of is that through different deaths within my family, the process was different with each time of somebody dying. The grief became a different grief for one person and a different kind of grief for the other person.
Absolutely.
And the stages were different at times.
What makes that difference? Why is each grief different? I can think of a couple of things.
Depends on who it is and why they die.
Okay. The relationship?
Yeah.
The type of death? Was it sudden? Was it prolonged? Was it painful? Was it messy? What else?
Hate.
Yeah. Okay. How did they come to have the problem that they have? I think that's the one that gets us all hung up about AIDS, is our hang-ups about why that person got sick and did they deserve to be sick, and that's a whole other story.
I noticed that somebody was asking me, noticing different in Christian people, believing people, person is dying and non-believer is dying, are they more uncomfortable or not?
Oh, I think that's because those of us who are Christians, even if we have an intellectual assent to the love of God, our feet are made of clay. there are Christians and there are Christians, and I have no way of judging who's a better Christian or not. God doesn't guarantee us as Christians that we will not experience fear or pain. We have tools to cope with that, but some of us use those tools better than others. We are all sinners, and one of our sins is doubting the goodness of God.
Yeah, but she was asking, if there is non-Christian who doesn't believe there is God or nothing, are they more uncomfortable when they are dying, or do they panic in the past? I haven't noticed. I have been in a hospital, but have you? She was asking, and then I started thinking, have I noticed? They are more uncomfortable. Who says there is no God?
Yeah. I think that we all have a philosophy of life. And for me, and I would gather for most of the people in this room, the philosophy that integrates our lives is our faith in God, and specifically in His grace in Jesus Christ. But that does not mean that other people who are not Christians do not have a philosophy of life that guides them and guards them and comforts them.
I've experienced being with people in death, and looking at my own life, there was a time when I was out of the kingdom of God And my philosophy of life was such that I could have died in a foxhole. I was in the army at the time, and I wouldn't have been afraid, though not believing in a God. It wouldn't have been a painful, I mean, it wouldn't have been a frightening thing for me. Now there would be, I think, a considerable peace in my own dying, though I have observed in Christians a peacefulness, and I've also observed in Christians a horrible fearfulness at the very last. Did I do the right thing so that I will be with Jesus? Uh-huh. And though you've talked with him for 8-9 years, that it's not, I mean, there just comes the clay at the very end for many. And that doesn't mean that they have a week or a, you know, it just, you see it both ways all the time.
Seems to me that it would be very simple just to think that when I die, I'm gone. There's nothing afterwards. And then it's just a matter of preparing yourself ahead of time that you're not going to be with your friends and your loved ones. My time has come, and I'm gone. I'll be back. That seems so much simpler than Christianity.
There's something in the human spirit, though, across cultures, that seeks a meaning beyond our limited existence. And whether that's reincarnation or ancestor worship or an afterlife in heaven, I can't think of a successful, stable culture that doesn't have some way of making meaning out of death and some kind of personal or community or corporate immortality. Whether that's having your name on a building or whether that's having a shrine where your descendants come and place flowers, or whether it's believing you may come back as a cow or a monkey or another human being. I think that every time that a culture has tried to say that we're above this, some other new weirdness has popped up. I see that in our country right now in some of these fringy sorts of, or groups that we as Christians in this country consider fringy, the people who consult mediums and this, who's this character, Boopsy in Trudeau's thing that thinks she's in communication with Ra and all kinds of other garbage. Or even these people with the New Age, with the crystals and whatnot. All of this is a way of saying there's some meaning in life beyond my existence from birth to death. And for me and for my house, I choose to follow Christ. But that's not a choice that everyone makes. My Christianity is, I don't know that my faith is the right answer, but it's the answer that fits for me, that makes the best sense out of life and living for me. And I think that that's, to me, that's the way I have to share my Christian faith. And I think that unlike Muhammad, who went around with an army and said, you will believe or else, Christ said, come and follow me. And if you don't, I'm moving on and you're going to be left behind. I don't think we can force it. And I don't think that any of these things related to grieving that we can force, we can facilitate for those we care about. We can even facilitate them for ourselves. But we can't say, there are 4 stages of grief, and I'm going to skip these 3, and I'm going to go on to acceptance because I'm a Christian. Sorry! You're human, I'm human, we're going to go through it. Hopefully, we're going to go through it with more grace. We're maybe going to go through it more smoothly. Hopefully we're going to gather our community around us to support us. Any of you that were at the Bible study this morning, Wes was talking about the call to community. into real intimacy with each other. And I know Wes has talked a lot about the presence of Christ within community and experiencing Christ in our brothers and sisters. And I think for anyone who has experienced that kind of community, that it's a very powerful thing and something that I think we need to share as a real message. Monday through Saturday, there's a Bible study here at 9 o'clock. Wes was only here this week. There'll be a new one starting on Monday. Typically, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday fit together as some kind of a theme. And they usually have just some wonderful theologians, whether they're official theologians or and usually they are. They're professors from seminaries and things of that sort. Wes happened to be on the Catholic tradition. Others have been Lutheran pastors. Others have been seminary professors. Thursday is usually led by the village pastor, who will be giving the sermon on Sunday evening on the texts, the lectionary texts for the week. So, highly recommend them. The times that I've been here, that's probably been the highlight of the week for me. But I think that one of the things I see, my expertise is in the biology of what happens in illness. But what I like about coming here and talking about it is I can talk about how it integrates into the rest of our lives, and that's something that I see a sore need for. I was trained in an era that said, you must be value neutral. You must not bring faith into the exam room or the hospital. And I think the truth to that is, you can't force your values and your beliefs. But people's beliefs, whether they're psychological beliefs or spiritual beliefs, clearly affect their health, not just their mental health, but their physical health. And it's time.